I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Rag Radio is produced in the studios of KOOP 91.7 in Austin, Texas. And it's a co-op is a cooperatively run, all-volunteer community radio station. It's very unique, and it's very cool. We're broadcast live from 2 to 3 every Friday. We're also rebroadcast by stations in Pennsylvania and Houston. So, and all of our shows are streamed live, and we have a very wide audience out there, and we put up podcasts of each show after the after broadcast. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. How are you doing, Tracy?
Doing well. Happy to be here. Okay. Nice day out.
It is. It's, well, I
bright,
guess.
Bright and sunny, at least
if,
where we're at.
If you like, you know, perspiration.
Yeah.
But it's going to get much worse this week. We're going to get up into the hundreds, it looks like.
Later. Hey, speaking of getting up in the hundreds, yeah. Somebody reminded me before we started the show, it's like, you have a birthday coming up. It's like next week, right? It's like it's a magic number 70, right? Is that right?
No. 60? I couldn't. It's not possible.
40?
Maybe it is 70. but you know, once you get to 70, you can't remember how old you are. So
yeah,
I am about to hit that magic number. And speaking of which, I will tell people that there's going to be a massive. I don't know how massive it's going to be, but we're having a gathering of the tribes in Houston, gathering of the Austin and Houston tribes,
right,
to celebrate my 70th birthday party, and it's also a benefit for the Rag Blog and the New Journalism Project. So that's going to be the second. My birthday's the first, but that's going to be on August 2nd at Baba Yaga in Houston from 5 to 8 p.m. So everyone's welcome.
Oh, that's a good deal. Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, on with the show. My guest today is Eve Spangler. Dr. Spangler is a sociologist and a human and civil rights activist. Her new book is Understanding Israel, Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. For the last decade, Dr. Spangler's work has focused on the Israel-Palestine conflict. She believes that the problem in this conflict, quote, is Zionism, not religion, not even nationalism per se. And she says she is making an argument for human rights to be the bedrock of the quest for a just and sustainable peace going forward. According to Alice Rothschild, Spangler's book takes us on a brave and intimate journey into the consequences of Jewish privilege and Jewish victimhood, the agendas of imperial superpowers, and the Palestinian struggle for self-determination. Dr. Spangler graduated summa cum laude from Brooklyn College, received her MA from Yale, and her PhD from the University of Massachusetts, and blah, blah, and blah. but her main interests concern human rights in diverse settings, interestingly enough, ranging from Israel-Palestine to corporate workplaces. In her previous work, she focused on occupational safety and health, particularly for women. Eve Spangler, welcome to Rag Radio.
Thank you so much, and congratulations to Tracy on his 70th birthday. That's me next year. I don't know how that happened. But so we've been around a while and been involved in various projects.
Yeah, well, the 70th birthday, unfortunately, is mine, not Tracy's.
But, oh. So, well, congratulations.
Or fortunately, I made it to 70. I guess you can look at it that way. That's as good as any. So, okay, interesting trajectory from the corporate workplace to Israel and Palestine. How'd you make that journey?
Well, some of it, I think, was fate and some of it was coincidence. Let me start way at the beginning. My parents are refugees from the Holocaust who got lucky and wound up in America and in New York, where I grew up. You know, and part of that story is a very typical immigrant story, and some of it's very specific to what we're talking about today. So the part that's pretty typical of an immigrant story is I grew up with my parents having taught themselves English largely from the New York Times. So I got to school with a thick German accent. I was probably the geekiest kid in the history of the world because, you know, who goes to kindergarten saying, the Dow Jones average closed down 5 points today while in brisk trading? So I got sent to speech class. I was the kid who got picked last for teams in the schoolyard. And, you know, I think that's a pretty typical immigrant experience. And so I was one of those people who grew up standing a little at the margins of the circle, squinting her eyes and thinking, how does this all go together? And that person over there that I'm watching, why is he or she doing what they're doing? And what is it about the environment that makes it easier or hard to do that? And I got very lucky and found the community of people who think like that. It's called sociology. And I think most of us are people who stand at the edge of the circle and think, how does this all go together? So I've been doing sociology for a long time. And also because of the particulars of my family's history outrunning the Holocaust, my mom was the head chaperone on one of the very last children's trains that was permitted to leave Vienna and brought 27 children to safety on forged documents across Nazi-occupied Europe. And many, many families, of course, who have that kind of history go from the Holocaust to Zionism and to thinking Jews need a room of their own, there has to be a Jewish state, it's Israel, we've got to defend that, right or wrong. My family went down a kind of different path and said they're not interested in glorifying or sentimentalizing any state. States are dangerous. And what we really need is human rights. We need to be very vigilant about human rights. So I come from that path. And so I've gone from kind of one project to the next, interested in the question of how is it all put together and where are the human rights challenges. I started with, you know, my own biography, as many researchers do, and I started with what happens to blue-collar kids, kids from modest backgrounds who go to college. And I went from that into women in the workplace. And then I was at a point where I had just finished a project. And so the faith part was I've always been interested in human rights, and that comes from my family. And the coincidence is I was between two projects, and a colleague came into my office one night and said, I've put together this talk on Israel-Palestine, and I'm afraid there's not going to be an audience. You've got to come to the presentation. And I thought, oh, darn, I was going to go home and read my book club novel and drink wine. But I went to the presentation, and, you know, the Palestinian spoke. It was a Palestinian academic and an Israeli academic working in an organization called Faculty for Israeli-Palestinian Peace. And the Palestinian spoke first, and he talked about the expulsion of Palestinians, a half to two-thirds, the destruction of Palestinian villages, about three-quarters of them, associated with the creation of the State of Israel in 47, 48, 49. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I knew nothing about that. Well, you know, that's the Palestinian. Let's hear what the Israeli has to say. And the Israeli got up and pointed to the Palestinian and said, what he says is not nearly harsh enough. It's much worse than what he said. And I thought, wow. And I got hooked. And so here we are.
Well, it's interesting. Your personal history and moving in that direction. I wonder, obviously, there was a heavy strain of Zionism among survivors of the Holocaust.
Sure.
But I think probably you're not unique in your personal narrative. From your experience?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, one of the things that's a little frustrating is, and has been to me for a while, is sort of who controls Jewish history and who speaks for Jews, because we're a loquacious and argumentative people, and I don't think anybody speaks for us. So, you know, I do a lot of work with Jewish Voices for Peace, with America Jews for a Just Peace, and these are groups who, like me, have not gone down the Zionism track, but down the human rights track. And, you know, I first noticed that when I was actually working on worker health and safety, and I was with a group that did a lot of work in the post-Soviet, post-1989, 1990 Eastern Europe, and I was in Krakow for a conference, and there was a big exhibit about the Jews of Krakow before Nazism. So I went to that, and, you know, it was put on by an American Jewish group, I think the UJA, but I'm not sure. And there were lots of photographs, and everybody in the photographs was Orthodox. They were all wearing hats and had sidelocks and prayer shawls, and the women were covering their head. And I thought, my God, it's not enough what the Nazis did to my family. These people are erasing my family, too. You know, we were secular, assimilated Jews. And, yes, there are a good many of them and a good many of us. Stalin used to refer to Jews as rootless cosmopolitans. And, you know, I wear that label proudly.
Rootless cosmopolitan.
You betcha.
Okay. I'll accept that one, too. Okay. That right now, the big issue that it seems like people have almost, to some extent, although there's a lot of action here in Austin, and I know there's a lot of activism around Palestine and Israel and the and Gaza and whatever in activist communities. But the general, it seems like in general, a lot of people have almost given up the idea that there can be a solution. Iran and the nuclear deal is kind of, is at the top of the conversation at this point. And and it also brings into question this idea of what, well, especially Israel and the stance it takes in the world, and the sort of, you know, the fact that across the political spectrum in Israel, the idea is that this Iran deal will doom Israel. I'm not sure what the question is here, but take off from that.
Well, I think the question is that sort of twofold. One, the Middle East is in turmoil. You know, right now at the top of the news is Iran. A month ago it was ISIS. A month from now it might be something else. The Israel-Palestine
Donald Trump, maybe.
Donald Trump. and I'm not going to go there.
I don't.
But, you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict has been going on, depending on how you define it, since 1880 or since 1948 or since 1967, and it keeps coming back. And so I think that's important to note. And, you know, when you think about all of the difficulties in the Middle East, Iraq and Syria crumbling, Lebanon being a fragile coalition, Egypt being consumed with its internal difficulties, somehow the Israel-Palestine conflict, while it's not central in the pragmatic sense that everybody would be happy if we could just resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict, it is central in the sense that it's part of everybody's imagination there. And the sympathy of the Arab world, not Arab rulers necessarily, but Arab people, ordinary men and women, for the Palestinian plight, is very much part of people's imagination. And so if you could craft a solution in Israel-Palestine that was stable, just, peaceful, sustainable, the contribution that would make, not just to the people living in Israel and Palestine, but to the whole world, to everybody's ability to imagine a better future, to imagine that it's not a choice between secular autocracies and religious autocracies, I think that can't be understated. So it's a just and sustainable peace is something worth fighting for, both locally for people involved directly, but worldwide. And I think that's very important.
Okay, you point out that Israel and Palestine is slightly larger than the state of New Jersey.
That's right.
And in the context of, why don't you give us a little bit of background on how all this came about and sort of put it in some context for us?
Okay, well, so let me try and establish a few facts quickly. Yes, you're right. Israel-Palestine together is a little bit larger than New Jersey. And very importantly, it's located, you think about the map, on the land bridge between Asia and Africa and between Europe and Asia. And so it has been, from the beginning of time, the most multicultural, the most multilinguistic, the most multiethnic, the most multiracial, the most multi-everything place in the world. Everybody, except maybe the Aztec and the Inca, have been there. The Pharaohs were there, the Israelites were there, the Canaanites were there, the Seljuks, the Sassanids, the Caliphate, the Crusaders, the British, the Ottoman, the Greeks, the Romans, everybody has been there. And perhaps most importantly for the present conflict, descendants of the Israelites are still there, were there, and are still there. And descendants of the Philistines, who in the Old Testament coexist with the Israelites, are there and still are there and were there. Philistine is the Arabic word for Palestine. So from the very beginning of biblical time, this land has been Israeli and Palestinian, and multicultural and multi-ethnic. The question is what to do with that. And the problem is not that Jews want to be there, because they've always been there. I take students, we're jumping ahead a little here, but I teach a course at BC, and then I take my students who are in that seminar to visit human rights activists in Israel and Palestine every winter. And so just last January when we were there, we were in Nablus, which is supposed to be a very militant community in the West Bank, anti-Zionist, anti-Israeli community. And there in the middle of Nablus is a huge Jewish community, the Samaritans, who are there since biblical times, who are treated by the Israeli government as Jews. They're given Israeli passports and Israeli license plates. And so I was talking to this very militant Nablusi guy and said to him, well, you know, you're saying all this about Israel, but there, right across the street, is the Samaritan community. And he said, oh, no. They've always been here. They're neighbors. They come as neighbors, not as conquerors. We have no problem with that. So we've always had Palestinians and we've always had Israelites in this part of the world. The thing that changes is that Zionism comes in after World War II. Well, Zionism really began in the 1880s, but it comes in, you know, full force in the context of the Second World War and the Holocaust. And it becomes a political project that went down a fork in the road. And I'm going to argue, and I know this is controversial, but it went down, for my values, the wrong fork in the road. The choice was not for it to be a Jewish homeland and for Jews to add themselves into a multi-ethnic population. The Zionist project has become to build an exclusively Jewish state, a state that serves one ethno-religious group and controls a territory where half the people under its control are not members of that ethno-religious group and have an inferior set of rights. And that, I think, is an unsustainable project.
Okay, remember where you are. We need to take a break. My guest is Eve Spangler, and we're talking about, and she's the author of Understanding Israel, Israel/Palestine, and issues related to that book and to much more. We'll be right back. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. Very nice. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio, and my guest is Eve Spangler, and we're talking about Zionism, Palestine, and human rights, among other things. Eve, welcome back. Dr. Spangler.
Please. It's bad enough being 69. Just call me Eve.
It's not as bad as... Well, I'm 69, so it's...
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
Okay. In terms of the sort of picture, the background picture, that you... Is there anything more you want to add to that at this point?
No, I think why don't we leave it at that?
All right.
But I do have a story to share if you want a story.
Oh, a story would be wonderful.
Okay, well, this story, I guess the question
is... Since you're not a musician and we can't ask you to do another number...
No,
yes,
you wouldn't
please.
Want to do that. I couldn't carry a tune in a paper bag. You don't want to ask me for musical input. I'm thinking, what have I outlined? You know, these people have been there forever, but now they don't get along because there's this political project which privileges one group over the other. And I think maybe the best way to capture that is a story that is for me, very poignant. I went to Brooklyn College, which at the time I was there was largely Jewish. And I had a friend there, Ruthie, who married a guy quite a bit older than she and I are, and he became and is quite Orthodox. But we're still in touch after all these years, and occasionally they visit me. And so we were sitting around one night and reminiscing and sharing family histories, And her husband, Isaac, was talking about being a little boy, 7 or 8 years old, during the Holocaust. And he was a good little boy, and he, you know, honored his father and loved his teachers and revered his rabbi, and he went to a yeshiva school. And at some point, he became very aware that the grown-ups in his life were doing a great deal of whispering behind closed doors. And being the bright, energetic, curious little boy that he was, he took to listening at those closed doors to hear what he could hear. And pretty quickly, he realized that he didn't understand what was being said. He didn't really understand the details. They didn't make too much sense to him. But the thing that he did understand was that the people who were the giants of his life, his father, his rabbi, his teachers, people he thought knew everything, could do anything, that they were talking about something so senselessly horrible and evil that they trembled in fear. And I could see him there sitting in my living room, you know, an elderly gentleman, but you could still see that curious little boy listening at the door, studying fear. And the challenge now is that, of course, there is also, along with Isaac, who studied fear back in 1943, we have little Ishaq today, and he is perhaps in Gaza where maybe his home is so bombed out that there's not even a closed door for him to listen, or maybe he's in a refugee camp in Lebanon because his grandfather was driven out of Palestine and now his parents have been driven out of Syria, and they are refugees for the third time in a refugee camp in Lebanon. And that little Ishaq is, you know, a good little boy who loves his father and reveres his teachers and listens to his imam. And he's listening at the door, seeing the giants of his universe trembling in fear. And the question is, what do we do with that? How do we pay that forward? How do we build a society in which no child has to be listening at the door, studying fear?
How do we do that? I mean, one thing, you stress hope a lot in your work.
I do.
And you don't, I guess you don't feel that the situation is doomed. How do we move that forward?
Well, let me say two things. One, I do think that in difficult situations, people need hope. And not just, you know, greeting card, bumper sticker hope because it's nice to be hopeful. But that hope has to have legs. It has to be grounded in something. And so my hopes in Israel-Palestine are grounded in a bunch of things. One is that the politicians aside, and the politicians on both sides are really a problem, but the politicians aside, these are two actually culturally very compatible populations, the Israelis and the Palestinians. They are both ferociously interested in education. Among Palestinians, this is now declining, but when I first began going there, the most traditional way that a man would introduce himself is to say, how do you do? My name is Tariq or Adnan or Thorne, and I have so many children, 5 perhaps, and 2 of them are doctors and 2 of them are lawyers and 1 is an engineer. The Palestinians have the highest per capita PhDs of any Arab population, the highest college enrollment. So these are two populations who are very interested in education. And they are two populations who are extremely entrepreneurial. The Palestinian economy had a favorable balance of trade with Europe for almost a century before Zionism began. So there is a basic compatibility of the populations, not much emphasized in their political culture at the moment, to be sure, but there is that basic compatibility there. There is also, we have a lot of tools. You know, we do, after all, live in a society where we have some political freedoms, not perfectly realized, but we do. So we can lobby, we can educate in our churches and on our campuses and in our communities. We can use economic tools like the boycott, sanctions, divestment movement, which is embedded in the very nature of capitalism itself. Adam Smith, who was a moral philosopher, not a technocrat, econometrics guy, you know, hoped that by shopping freely and working where we chose and investing where we chose, we could not only satisfy our material needs, but we could build the kind of community we want to see. And so we do a lot of that. you know, not even with regard to Israel-Palestine. We go to dinner with our friends in a restaurant, and if somebody needs it, we expect a gluten-free menu selection, and we read consumer reports before we buy a car or an appliance. And so we certainly can use boycott, sanctions, and divestment to say, you know, we don't support illegal settlements, and we don't support an ethno-religiously exclusive state that is not fair to all of its citizens and all of the people under its control. We can ask the American government to strip tax exemptions from churches and synagogues that build illegal settlements. We don't have to give tax subsidies to illegal activities. So we have a lot of tools. And palpably, I think, in churches and on campuses, the climate is changing, the conversation is changing. So I'm optimistic because education works and conversation works, and that's a good thing. And lastly, I'm optimistic because ultimately the people who live there are the ones who will have to live the change. And, you know, I have met both Israelis and Palestinians and some of my own students, too, who give me hope for the future. So, you know, I was talking to an Israeli soldier who said, you know, my father fought in the 73 war, the Yom Kippur War, and I love my dad, and, you know, if I thought about it at all, I thought, well, my dad's a good man, so he wouldn't have killed good people. He would have only killed bad people. And then when I began doing peace work, I met Palestinians who were in the 73 war, one even who was in the same battle as my father and could have killed my father or been killed by my father, and he too was a good man. And I realized my whole life was built on a lie, and I had to rebuild it from the ground up. You know, when I hear an Israeli soldier saying that, I have hope. You know, I have hope when I see Jews living peacefully in Nablus. I have hope. I have hope, you know, when I read that although Palestinian prisoners are never allowed conjugal visits, there have now been 35 children born to wives of Palestinian prisoners through smuggled sperm. You know, there's a commitment to life ongoing in that that gives me hope.
All right.
And if you can indulge me in one more story, give me hope. We were in Hebron, and we had been to the Rachel's tomb, and you walk down a hill, and you turn into a very wide boulevard kind of street there, and you see that it is divided by a concrete divider, about one quarter of the street on one side and a wide three quarters on the other side. And Palestinians, even Palestinians who live on that street, are only allowed to walk down the narrow side of the street. And Israelis are permitted to walk and drive cars down the wide side of the street. And I've seen this now many times. And I always like to stand in a place where I can watch my students' faces when they first see that, and particularly the students, my African-American students. So we were there, and we were walking. We were a big group, and we were walking down the Israeli side of the street, and caught up in our group was a little Palestinian child, really no more than 4 or 5, who was trying to sell us trinkets. And because of the way the occupation has closed businesses in Hebron, those trinkets probably were a significant part of his family's income. So we're walking down this divided street and talking to this child, and then we walk on, not realizing that as we recede, we've left this little 5-year-old Palestinian child exposed on the wrong side of the street. And we'd taken no more than 2 or 3 steps into the next block. We heard him scream, just shriek. And so we all stopped in our tracks and turned around. And he had run into the doorway of a building and was cowering with his hands over his head. And 2 Israeli soldiers, whom we hadn't seen, I don't know where they came from, were approaching him with their gun butts raised like they were going to bash him in the head. And my students, without saying a word, without even looking at each other, they just knew what to do. They walked back. They didn't get between the soldier and the child. They didn't put themselves at risk. They just formed a semicircle around the soldiers and stared at them and raised their cameras. And the soldiers looked at us twice, and then they put their guns down and they motioned the kids to just scram, and we formed a circle around them and walked them home. So it's a story of terror, but it's also a story of hope. I don't know how my kids, in that moment, without any discussion, without any direction, they knew what to do. And so, you know, I have hope, but I hope the hope has legs.
All right. Those are great stories. Interestingly enough, we had, I guess week before last, my guest was Dr. Mary Bach, who's a journalism professor at UT Austin. And one of the things that she's talking about is, well, see, the role of social media, citizen journalism, and the incredible role that smartphones and phone cameras are having in sort of, one, changing journalism, but also changing, maybe having an effect on our society and keeping people to account, I guess. So,
yes.
All right. The hope issue is so incredibly important, and I have known a number of people. I haven't gone, but I've known a number of people who've gone to Palestine and who have similar stories. And I don't think there's any question about that. If we look at it on a human level, on a humanistic level, on a real personal level, there's lots to be hopeful about. My question is how much the problem is institutionalized, how much it's based on economics, how much it's based on imperialism, and I think part two is are we generally looking at an apartheid state here?
Well, there are there is of course a huge institutional component because this conflict has been going on really since the beginning of Zionism. There were, before Zionism, large Arab Jewish communities, that is, people who were religiously Jewish but ethnically living in Arab countries, speaking Arab, eating Arab food, listening to Arab music. And they did better, actually, than Jews in Christendom and medieval Europe, say. But since the beginnings of Zionism and since the political commitment that Zionists have chosen to build an ethno-religiously exclusive state, even when half the people under their control don't belong to that group, there are, of course, massive structures now that keep this stuff in place and that will have to change, and that would have to change. So, yes, I think that needs to be said. At the same time, you know, nobody really thought that South Africa was going to not be a bloodbath, and it wasn't. I think people thought Northern Ireland was completely intractable, and it's not perfect, but it's better. I don't think in 1945 anyone could have imagined that the German-French border would really basically not exist and you would be waved through. So, yes, those institutional arrangements will have to change, but that is not beyond human agency to do.
Can we have change without getting rid of the settlements? Or at least stopping their advance, but and denying them the kind of privileges they have.
It's very difficult to give you a simple answer to that. I don't mean to be evasive, but I think, and we're talking a lot about Zionism, not, I think, because I want to privilege Jewish safety over Palestinian safety, as I hope Isaac and Isaac establish, but because it's the doctrine that changed the dynamic. It's the active agent. So Zionists have said they want three things. They want a Jewish state, they want to be democratic, and they want all the land. Now, those are three things that just do not go together. You can have any two of those three, and so you could be Jewish and democratic if you were willing to pull the Jewish state back inside the Green Line. That would mean dismantling or abandoning or somehow shifting the settlements and creating a Jewish state only in that territory where Jews are the supermajority. Then you could be Jewish and democratic, but you wouldn't have all the land. And that is the so-called universally agreed upon two-state solution, which, you know, the Israelis didn't get that telegram. But anyway, that would be a two-state solution.
When we come back after the break, by the way, I'm going to ask you why you support a one-state solution.
Okay. And I guess we're going on break.
Well, we might as well.
Okay.
Okay. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Eve Spangler, who's the author of Understanding Israel-Palestine, that's with a slash, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Red Radio. Tracy, you sing very well.
Well, that was a nice selection picked by our guest.
And those musicians, where did they come from? Now they ran out. So.
Okay. Who was that, ma'am? It's like that was. I have it down as Farouz. Is that right? That's how you pronounce her name?
Yes.
Yeah.
She's a Lebanese singer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very cool. Very nice.
Okay, and my guest is who Tracy was just talking to is Eve Spangler. We're talking about Zionism, Palestine, human rights, all of that kind of stuff, and where that takes us. I said that we would talk about why you support a one-state solution and what you mean by that, and we will in just a second, but I just wanted to follow up once more on what we were talking about in the settlements and in terms of institutionalization. One thing that it seems to me we have to overcome is sort of the idea, the demonizing, the seeing people, the devaluation of life, seeing people as the other. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that's a major issue, not just in Israel and Palestine, but elsewhere too.
Yes, because Black Lives Matter.
Yes, absolutely. So
yes.
Okay.
Yes, so the demonization and the institutionalization of that is very profound and very difficult. I will come to that. Let me go back. Zionism to the where we left off, in which Zionism says it wants three things: to be democratic, Jewish, and to have all the land.
Right.
So if you're Jewish and democratic, you're small and you don't have all the land, and you're part of a two-state solution where the other guys get to have some land and be Muslim and Christian and
okay.
democratic. You can have all of the land and be democratic, then you must become a state of all the people you govern and not an ethno-religiously exclusive state that grants rights to one group of people and not another. And that's the one-state solution, which I favor because I like multi-ethnic, multi-everything states. The really wretched combination is what's going on now, which is the choice to be Jewish and have all the land. And that means you have a Jewish state that controls everything from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean and has for more than 40 years, almost 50 years, and has a set of legal institutions and economic institutions and cultural institutions which privilege half the population, the half that's Jewish, and which disadvantages the other half that are Palestinian, Christian, and Muslim in a variety of ways. Some of them are citizens of Israel and have some rights, but certainly not the same rights that Jews do. And some of them live in the occupied West Bank and Gaza and have no right. In the West Bank, they have no rights, and in Gaza, they have no roof over their head. Some of them are in East Jerusalem, and they live on permits rather than passports because they've been allegedly annexed in an annexation that's illegal and that no one acknowledges, no other state acknowledges. So there's a variety of configurations of disadvantage of being Palestinian between the river and the sea. That goes from being homeless and without shelter to being someone who can be elected and serve in the Knesset, but who cannot enjoy family reunification and who cannot build a house without a permit.
I'm interested in the role that the United States plays in all of this, and the United States has certainly been an uncritical supporter of Israel throughout
yeah.
the years, and we won't go into hypocrisy, of this all of this, but obviously we condemn theocracies in other parts of the world, and yet we turn a blind eye to what is becoming increasingly a theocracy, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
In Israel. We look the other way. I mean, we condemn anybody who's trying to build a bomb, and yet a nuclear bomb, and yet
yeah.
we just look the other way. We ignore the fact that Israel is, one would believe, a nuclear power, and yet is in violation of every law in every world.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what has to happen here? Because so many people in our politics depend so much on money from the Israeli lobby and are so intimidated, I would think, is one thing. What do we do here?
What has to happen here? Well, I think what has to happen here And it's not going to start with politicians. It's going to start with grassroots. And politicians do, in fact, listen to people in their home districts. And, you know, of course, they also listen to lobbyists, but they do listen to people in their home districts. And so it's going to have to start as conversations where America has always changed its mind on civil rights, on gay marriage, on environmental issues, on women's issues. It's going to have to be robust conversations in our churches, in our synagogues, in our mosques, and on our campuses that I think are going to change people's understanding that we have been guided by some combination of the safety of Israel and our own economic self-interests and not by human rights criteria in resolving this conflict. And if we're going to continue to play a role, then the role that America has to play is to say that human rights has to be the bedrock of any long-term sustainable solution. Everybody who's there gets to stay there, and everybody who's there gets to be treated right, because nothing else is sustainable in the long run. Now, that would be a sea change for American foreign policy, because we've always been driven by more narrowly self-interested goals for a very long time, the Cold War, in which, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and it's led us into very unsavory alliances, as you say, with dictators, with, you know, religious fanatics, with all kinds of people we should not have been allied with and have lived to regret. So I think the change is, this time around, is going to have to come from the grassroots, and I'm optimistic that it's happening, you know, obviously not as fast as I would like it to, but it is happening. And that, I think, will be significant. I also think what's important is that even for the institutional changes that need to happen on the ground in Israel and Palestine, there are people all over the place who you never hear about on the news who are working on that very project, sometimes just as Palestinians or just as Israelis, and sometimes in joint groups. So, for example, there's a geographer whom I've met who's a wonderful man. His name is Oren Yiftachel, and he's an Israeli-Jewish professor of geography at Ben-Gurion University. And he, with Palestinian colleagues, is working on expert testimony to oppose the Israeli state's demolishing of Bedouin communities in the Negev. The Israeli state has taken the position that they're going to, quote, Judaize the Negev, and that means removing the Bedouin. And he's providing expert witness testimony along with Palestinian colleagues about how that does not have to happen and what alternatives are available. The Austrian Rena Bauer Institute is hosting conversations between, among others, Avram Burg, who's a former speaker of the Israeli Knesset, and Sam Bahur, who's the founder of Paltel, the first big cell phone telephone company in Palestine, and a whole working group that are figuring out how you could integrate the economy. So there are many, many of these groups, only Israeli, only Palestinian, and joined Israeli-Palestinian. There is a real library of possible plans and solutions that, you know, politicians on neither side are listening to, but that grassroots imagining a better future, that work is being done.
We're speaking with Eve Spangler, sociologist and human rights activist. But how embedded, you know, we talked about institutional stuff, but I mean, it seems like, and I'm not, I mean, I absolutely agree with you about the need for a kind of grassroots change, a sea change in how people view things, but how difficult is that going to be? How much is what is in is Israel is public opinion in Israel and Israeli, certainly the parties, the Israeli parties, how much is going to have to change? How do we move towards a one-state solution? And what are the steps other than just we have to have grassroots, you know, we have to...
Well, you know, what has to change in public opinion? I think again, there has to be challenge, and, you know, it's not for the American grassroots to tell Israelis or Palestinians how they have to live. It's for us to tell our own government how we want to be represented. But similar, you know, efforts will have to be made because, you know, the human individual side of that institutionalized hatred and fear plays itself out in examples like in 2010 on the trip, that was in the middle of Operation Cast Lead, my group was in Jerusalem on a Friday, and I happened to have that year 5 Arab-American students in the group, and they came to me and said, look, we would really like to go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque for the Friday noon prayers. And I said, okay, but you've got to come out immediately because you're inside the Haram al-Sharif, which is walled, inside the Old City, which is walled, so you're behind a double wall, and the demonstrations start the minute the noon prayers are over, and I don't want anybody getting tear gas, so you've got to come back immediately and meet us at the Jerusalem Hotel Garden where we're having lunch. So the 4 boys came back, and the girl didn't, and I said, where is she? And they said, oh, they made the girls go out by a different door. She's right behind us. Well, 10 minutes went by. It was a very long 10 minutes in my life. And then she appeared, and she was kind of white and looked a little shaken, and she was just this very pretty, generically Mediterranean, dark hair, dark eyes, olive skin girl. And I said to her, did you get tear gassed? And she said, no, I got lost. I found myself in the Jewish quarter. And I went into a store, and I said, can you direct me back to the Arab quarter? I have to find the Damascus Gate. And the shopkeeper, young man, looked at her and said to her, why would you want to go there? And she said, well, I'm a student. I have to rejoin my professor in my group. And he said, what are you? I wish she had said, I'm a human being. But she said, I'm American. And he said, no, that's not what I'm asking you. Are you Jewish? And she said, no, I'm Muslim. And he said, oh, what a waste of a pretty girl.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's going to have to change. And yeah. That's going to
Well, we're talking about changing a culture.
We're talking about changing a culture. But, you know, again, there is material in the history of that culture. I mean, people talked about us as Jews that way. This is a history that Israelis know well. You know, my mother used to say one of the things that most annoyed her in Vienna is when people said about her, oh, that's Jeanette. She's Jewish, but she's a nice woman, you know, but she's Jewish. As though it was really surprising that a Jewish person could be a nice person. Every Jew has those stories in their past. We all know better than to say, what a waste of a pretty girl. So, you know, those things have to be tapped. Now, of course, there is also a potentially very difficult scenario transition to the one-state solution, which is, and I think it's the more, truthfully, a likely one, which is that Israelis do not proactively consent and say, oh, what were we thinking? We were so wrong. Of course we should do human rights. Let's all have a happy one-state, bi-national, bilingual, no problem. What is more likely to happen is that they will miscalculate at some point and push the Palestinian Authority into collapse. I mean, Mahmoud Abbas is 80 years old. You know, he is under a lot of pressure, whatever one thinks of his performance. He is absolutely opposed to any kind of effective succession planning in the PA. So this could collapse. The Israelis could tumble into a one-state solution rather than walking into it.
Okay.
And I think that is actually a rather likely scenario.
Quickly here, the one obvious issue that so many face is the identification that people have between anti-Zionism, between opposing Israeli politics and anti-Semitism. And so how do we overcome that, or how much is that changing? And, you know, and this is all in the face of a, at least in Europe, what appears to be a rising neo-fascist movement and some pretty major exhibitions of anti-Semitism growth of anti-Semitism,
yeah,
especially in France, but elsewhere too.
Well, I don't have any solution for French anti-Semitism, but I do think we need to keep saying that.
But I mean, I guess I'm asking, does that fuel You know, I mean, we have no answer for French anti-Semitism, maybe, but does the fact of the rising anti-Semitism fuel that kind of tendency to associate anti-Semitism as anyone?
I think that the Israeli state and the sort of AIPAC community in America has done everything within its power long before there was any rising anti-Semitism in France to conflate legitimate criticisms of Israel with anti-Semitism. And I think we have to know our history, and we have to keep quoting. I'm content that AIPAC won't like me if I get to stand with Hannah Arendt, who said a Jewish homeland should never be sacrificed to the pseudo-sovereignty of a Jewish state built on Arab suppression. I feel like when I stand with Hannah Arendt, I'm in good company.
Definitely are.
Or Martin Buber, who said excessive nationalism can only lead to a tiny state of Jews completely militarized and unsustainable. You know, as long as I have Arendt and Buber and Einstein on my team, AIPAC can, you know, have whoever they want on their team. I'm satisfied with that.
Okay, give me about a 30-second summation or sense of where things are going or what you're hoping for. What do you want to leave us with?
I want to leave us with the notion that Americans should stand up for human rights as the bedrock, the standard by which we address the Israel-Palestine conflict. We don't rule the world. We can't make either Israelis or Palestinians do everything we think should happen. But we can, as Americans, insist that human rights are the standards by which we wish to address the conflict.
Okay. And do you feel hopeful? I know you've said earlier.
I do feel hopeful, yes.
Do you feel, let me say something else. Hope, there's a difference between hope and optimism. Do you feel optimistic?
I think there's a long road ahead of us, and I think it's not at all impossible that things could get worse before they get better. But I am hopeful. I don't know who I'm quoting here, but someone said the arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I ground my hopefulness in that.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us on RAG Radio. Eve Spangler, author of Understanding Israel Palestine.
Thank you, Thorne, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you very much, and we'll do this again.
Thank you.
I should mention that next week on RAG Radio, we're turning the tables, and I'm being interviewed.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you have Mr. Nightbird coming in. It's like giving us like a little Q&A.
Jeffrey Nightbird is going to interview me next week on RAG Radio. Also, remind people that. The big event in Houston, my 60th birthday party, and a big RAG blog, New Journalism Project, which is the nonprofit that publishes the RAG blog, is next Sunday, 5 to 8 p.m. at Baba Yaga in the Montrose in Houston. So,
very cool.
Way cool. That's not this coming Sunday, but the Sunday a week, the August 2nd.
Oh.
Thank you. Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.